FM Ann Arbor. Now is time for Living Writers.
Preachers and the husbands and the wives.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hutzel, and today I'm so happy to have Danielle Evans here in the studio in person, flown in this morning from Baltimore. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back after what I've just shockingly realized was like 15 years ago and not 10.
I know. It's weird how I, too, lop off like half decades in time, or I think, how could it be possible? Because thinking about it, when we were walking over here today, everybody, I said to Danielle, as soon as I saw that you were coming with the Zell Visiting Writer series, again, I put a heart like next to, because I was looking forward to having a chance to talk with you. But I think it still hasn't sunk in that it was 2010. In my mind, I think I have it at 2020 still or something like that. But welcome back to Ann Arbor. And you're here to do a reading in the Zell Visiting Writers series, and tomorrow at the Art Museum at 5:30.
Yes, I'm super excited. I'll be reading from the novel I've been working on for now. I'm not going to even try to guess how much time it's been, but somewhere between 10 and 15 years.
Yeah. And do you have like a working title for it so far?
Its working title is Black Magic, but that is very much subject to change.
And is it because the book itself, like, is still, like, you're still finding it, like, the way through it? Or are you in sort of one of the revisions part of the novel?
It's sketched out. It's complete with holes in it, so I need to fill in the gap. So I think it's just sometimes you have to fully see something to know what it should actually be called. And also, I think my editor is open to that title, but has not yet either signed off on it or had a chance to suggest things. And sometimes it's like you show something to somebody else and they can see it more clearly than you can. So it has not yet gotten to the stage where someone else has read it and been like, no, this is what it's called. So.
Right. Well, it's weird because you have such an intimate long-term relationship with this novel.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think when the book comes out into the world, that's when you have to talk about it all the time, but it already has started ceasing to belong to you and belongs to everybody else at that point. Like, the point at which it's yours is the point at which nobody else can see it.
It's true, yeah, because by the time it is like out in the world through the publishing cycle, it's been seen by so many, like your editor, like you said, other people. Like, do you also have trusted first readers and folks that you send parts out to?
Not really at this point, mostly because I'm so slow. Because my agent and my editor are incredibly patient and have generally been waiting for whatever I've been doing for longer than they should have. So I don't delay it by showing it to somebody else first. I give it to them right away. And they're both very sharp readers. So I find that whatever I need in terms of a pair of eyes or feedback, I'm generally going to get through that process.
And is it Riverhead?
Yes.
Again, Danielle. So because you've been with them since Don't Suffocate Your Fool Self, right?
Yeah, since 2007 we sold that book, so since I was a baby child.
That's true. Yeah. How does that you still are like in the scope of the universe, Danielle, you're still a baby child.
So. In my heart I feel that way, but I don't know that I've been teaching long enough that I'm like, the kids no longer feel that I am one of them. I can see it in their faces.
Yes. And I'm here to tell you it only becomes more so. I don't know. Oh, goodness.
It's not a bad thing necessarily, but it's I think when I first started teaching, I was about 25 and I had to spend the first couple of weeks earning my credibility and authority. And it's sort of strange to walk in and have them be like, oh, yes, she seems like she might know something. And yes. I guess this is nice.
Yeah. the instant credibility. Yeah. You wear the authority well, Danielle, really, really and truly. Well, it's so exciting to be able to have this chance to get to talk to you about the Office of Historical Corrections to a novella and stories out with Riverhead in 2020, because we didn't get a chance to talk back then. And I also got to tell you, like, this is a book that's come into my life at different times. Like, a couple of years ago, I was at the Institute for the Humanities, like a summer fellowship. And one of my fellow fellows, she was talking about this book. And I was like, oh, that's right, Danielle Evans. And yeah, so I feel like this book has had, I don't know, what is it like for you now thinking about this book, The Office of Historical Corrections, out in the world, the life it's had since 2020?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice that I get to keep talking about it because it did come out in fall of 2020. And so it had both a very warm reception, and I did that entire book tour like from my living room on Zoom with my cats making guest appearances. I'm sorry I could not travel with my cats. He would love to make a guest appearance on this show.
Oh, too. I would love it.
But it was strange because I do feel like, as much as it's strange to have this sort of intimate project out in the world, the return intimacy is that you get to like connect with people. And as much as I'm grateful that we had any kind of way to connect and do anything in 2020 while we were in lockdown, I also, you sort of don't get that return feedback. Like, you do the thing and then the camera clicks off and you're in your house with your cats. So it was a kind of both warm and very lonely release. And I'm glad that I'm still talking about the book years later, but it also is, I mean, it's a book that I was working on in a period of intense grief, and so sometimes it's strange to go back to that writing process years later and have to try to remember what I was feeling, but I'm glad that I have the chance to like continue to have the human part of the interaction.
Yes, it would be it's making me wish that I brought my copy of your Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self with me to kind of think about like your voice, because I hadn't thought about I don't know. I mean, this sounds really silly to say, because clearly you are the human being sitting in front of me here in this moment, and folks can hear your wonderful voice through the airwaves. But like that, the person who's writing the book, the voice and the mind of the book is changing through the time from the first collection of short stories in 2010 to 2020 when it was published.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about that book was because I was working on it over maybe like a 7-8 year stretch, and I was working on it kind of in secret because I was supposed to be working on a novel that did eventually become a version of it, became the novella that's at the end of that collection. But I was sort of holding on to short stories. And I think that in retrospect, yes, it's a good sign. It's a bad sign, rather, that you keep sort of having to abandon the project you're supposed to be doing to work on the thing you actually want to be doing. And that's probably a sign that your actual project is elsewhere, but it sometimes takes years to make that realization. And so in those years, I was sort of secretly working on short stories, and then I would only sort of send them to anybody when they were completely done. And then I did have like friend readers at that point, because I was like, I'm only going to send this to my agent if she feels like she can send it out and publish it immediately, so she won't be mad at me that I've been writing this short story instead of a novel. Because if I just say, like, here's a short story, can you help me think through it, she's going to be like, no, go work on the book that's under contract, in a very loving, supportive way. But like, that's the advice that one would give someone who was doing the wrong thing. So
it's kind of her job.
I had sort of been privately working on all of these stories, and some of them I was like, you know, I do like this story a lot. I want it to be published in a magazine, but it's too close to the novel material to like ever exist in a book on its own. So some of these are never going to be in a collection. And so it contains both some of the, at the time of the publishing, most recent work I'd done, and some things that I've been working on for years. There's a story, a revision of a story in there that we pulled from my first collection. Which is sort of one of the earliest things I'd written even for that collection. And then there's the novella that I had been working on in various forms for years and years. And there's also work that was sort of very written in like the year or two before the book came out. So it really is a kind of map of my brain over a long period of time. I kind of love, I mean, we're in a radio station. I'm looking, you guys can't see this, but there's all these sort of beautiful art of musicians on the walls and this very glittery drum set, which makes me wish that I played any kind of music. But I think a short story collection does work a little bit like an album, in which you're sort of like, the stories are having a conversation and they're not all saying the same thing, but there's something sort of, you want it to be an experience in some way. And so I do think it feels like, to me, that kind of a project.
Yeah. And it is an experience for the reader. That's like part of the, I don't know, like the power of the short story in a way that you can create, like, because there's space between them in a different way than if there's chapters.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's, even though I am sometimes aghast when people are like, oh, I just skip around in the collection. It is like an interactive experience. You can.
But you are saying you're aghast because it's intentional. Like when you're ordering the short stories, the arc of it is a real thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I do think that there's a journey and it's also an adaptable journey. So.
Well, because you're not going to be able to, I don't know, be the gatekeeper of it. Because the book is, like you said, at a certain point when it's out in the world, it's its own thing and it gets into the reader's hands and there's that exchange of energy, even like at the reading.
Yeah. At some point, every book is a choose your own adventure book.
Yeah. That makes me think if maybe you'll write one of those.
I think I tried once in like college, never again. It's too much logistics to manage.
To plot that out. Yeah. So with this, I love that you also said you were writing short stories in secret, like the secret, like it was almost your resistance to you, like writing, because you maybe were thinking in the short story form rather than the novel, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it was my mom was sick. And so, you know, there were good weeks and bad weeks, and it was much easier to kind of come in and out of shorter work. I think you have to stay, I don't think short stories are necessarily take less time to write, but I think it is easier. Some of that time is sitting time. Like I think inherently with a short story, there's some kind of fallow period when you have written it and you want to let it kind of simmer for a bit to think about what it is and go back to it with a fresh read. And that was better situated to my life at the time when sometimes I would have a month when I just couldn't write or reread anything or kind of go back to my work. So that was part of it, was just structurally my life was better set up for projects I could come in and out of, projects I could finish when I had the time and then let sit and not take forever to refamiliarize myself with. But I also think it was where my energy was. I think that I was interested in this collection in particular in thinking about time and thinking about structurally, I think some of these stories are shaped a little differently than the stories in my first book, which have a more traditional kind of narrative arc. A lot of them are not necessarily coming of age stories, but stories in which they're building to kind of a single moment that has some sort of lifelong reverberation. And I think in a story like that, the active plot, the thing that's happening, and the emotional plot, the kind of things we care about, tend to run kind of concurrently. Maybe the emotional plot's like a beat behind the active plot. And I think in this collection, I was thinking about what happens when the things that actually matter are not things that you have choices or have control about. So sometimes the active plots of these stories are people doing a lot of things to ignore the thing that actually matters because they can't control that thing. And the sort of emotional plot is just kind of sitting under it until it can't be ignored anymore. And the shape is slightly distinct.
And with the, when you were writing these stories, was the emotional plot, was that something that you named beforehand or something you started to feel with these, the stories in the Office of Historical Corrections?
I'm trying to think, you mean the actual term itself or in terms of me thinking about what the plot is in the stories?
More like for your own work, then we could talk about the term.
Yeah, no, I don't think I, you know, in the first draft, I never know what's going to happen. That's part of why I do like the short story form is that I get to be the first person who gets to be surprised. Someone asked me once, how do you know a story is finished? And I was joking, but not really. I know that it's finished when the story has tried to kill me and has failed. But I think what I mean by that is there's a moment when you realize what the story is actually about and it's horrifying, but you've already gone that far. Like you can't put the monster back under the bed. So I think there is a moment in which you tricked yourself into writing a thing and then understand the thing that you've actually written. But by that point, you're already there. Mm-hmm. And that moment of revelation is usually when I understand what the actual thing the story is about is. And then in revision, I can revise toward that. But the first draft is usually me not knowing where I'm going or thinking I'm going in one direction, and then suddenly having to confront the place that the story is actually going.
Thank you so much for talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is actually the fun part in a traumatizing way. I think that that's part of the pleasure, is that there is a lot of revelation and there is a lot of sort of discovery. You know, I became a writer because I love being a reader. I love being a reader because I liked being surprised and I liked discovering things and I liked thinking about what was underneath something. And that I still get to do that as a writer is the fun part some days.
Let's take a short break. Today on Living Writers, Danielle Evans is here in the studio at WCBN FM Ann Arbor. The book on the table, The Office of Historical Corrections, a novella and stories, out with Riverhead Books. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Reverend Andrew behind the glass. And Danielle, thanks for picking today's songs for the show. And thanks to JAV for pulling them for us, too. We'll be back.
Do not rush. And I learned bad my time. Well, baby, I was on your conscience. You were only on my mind. The ache of your body does not stop nor start with me. You are good at what you do. You are bad at what you know. It's just paper being moved.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time because Danielle Evans is here. The book on the table with us, The Office of Historical Corrections, a novella and stories, out with Riverhead Books 2020. And yes, thanks for picking the songs. You Danielle, you've got a the gift for the DJing, you know?
Well, I went back to, and I don't remember what I made it for, but I made a playlist for this book at some point. So all of these songs came from that playlist on my Tidal account. And so I don't even remember why I put all of them on there, but I picked from that thinking that Zia knew that we'd be talking about this collection.
Yeah. And trusting yourself from the time, like that the songs, so the songs must be like evocative of something, but it's not like you choose certain music to write to, or it's not part of your practice, or
you know, I get too distracted by lyrics. I can't listen to anything with words while I'm writing. I can sometimes listen to jazz, but that's it.
Yeah, and same. Otherwise, you'd find like I'd be suspiciously following like some of the lyrical twists and turns.
My next book will come out. It would just be like Fiona Apple. It seems familiar. Did she already write an album called that?
Fiona gets on the horn.
Excuse me.
Danielle, you'd have to be like, stop calling me. Stop calling me. Danielle Evans is here in town reading tomorrow at UMA at 5:30 in the Helmut Stern Auditorium. And there's a question and answer to follow, too.
Yes.
So that should be. Do you know who you'll be in conversation with by chance? Or?
I think it's just an audience Q&A. I'm actually not 100% sure, but I'm reading for 25 minutes and I timed it so that I would leave, but they wanted me to leave enough time for half of the time to be Q&A. So I believe it's just audience Q&A. But
that'll be really fun then, won't it?
Because
you never know what you're going to get too.
I actually, during that Zoom period, I missed the comment, not a question people. Like yeah. It was not their moment to shine. I was like, you know what? I would give anything to have them back now.
You never know what you'll miss, right? You never know. Well, be careful what you miss, because now we'll see. The folks are putting it on.
We only
the
want
cloud.
Nice comments, not questions. Comments.
And so that'll be tomorrow, the reading at UMA and Q&A. And then on Friday, you're going to be giving a craft talk at the Union on Friday morning, 10 a.m. And I think the title is Shifting Time and Perspective in Fiction.
We have just established that I cannot count and do not understand how time passes. I am, in fact, giving a craft lecture on time in fiction, which I am somewhat better about being able to articulate.
Well, because fiction is so different than real life, but sometimes it seems to actually be able to describe real life better than if you're writing nonfiction, or maybe even the emotional plot of life.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's an interesting way that often in the moments when we are most responding to fiction, it's because two time periods are somehow on the page at once, sometimes three. What I'm interested in thinking about in that craft talk is kind of the moments when something flickers, when we are flashing into the future, but briefly, or a kind of bit of backstory comes into a story and resets the whole thing. We're going to start with Edward P. Jones's The First Day, which is a story probably a lot of people know, but if you do know it, there's that clause kind of right in the middle of the first sentence, which is just starting with a child being taken to school on her first day of school by her mother. And there's a clause in the middle of the first sentence that says, long before I became ashamed of her, talking about her mother. And that just sort of resets the whole story. And so I'm interested in how just that little flicker of time can do so much for a story and can give us a sense that multiple time frames are existing in the same space, or that time is collapsing in some way. I don't know. I increasingly think that the villain of all stories is time. So oh. I think that the moments when we call attention to that are interesting.
Yeah, you've got a lot of quotable quotes, I'd say, Danielle.
I'm going to put myself in this wolf mug next time.
Yeah, that's true. We could have a series of living writers, like the quotes that folks say. The villain of all stories is time. It's interesting to think about drafting, like if Edward P. Jones in this, when I wonder, and maybe you know this, like maybe he's written about it or you know about it, but like when you're drafting something, sometimes those lines, like that actually is what comes to you in the first draft, even. It's not something that you place back, and that's part of the trying to understand what you write, I think.
Yeah, I don't, I've never seen anything on him by him on that particular story. But I do think sometimes I tell my students, you know, sometimes I get something where the tense keeps changing and I am a little like, you need to clean this up. But I'm also like, you need to pay attention to why the tense keeps changing here, because it's trying to tell you something. And right. It might be trying to tell you haven't decided yet what your point of view is and you just need to kind of clarify it. But it may also be trying to tell you that like this is a moment where the story feels like it's alive in some way. And you've got to figure out how to manage the time so we're not confused and it's not just grammatically incorrect. But there is maybe something happening with the time that you wanted to go into present tense there and think about like how you can do that in a way that isn't like chaotic.
I love that you're thinking about that when you're looking at student work too, like with this generous eye to see like what is actually happening, like respecting like the writer's attempt instead of like so often in like sometimes in school environments, like it's, you want to make like things correct and just knowing that correct is also often a matter of perspective.
Yeah,
and there's many corrects.
I mean, yeah, I do think aliveness. I want to point out where their work is like lacking something that makes it legible. But I also think, you know, my job is not to sort of, I was going to say the AI can correct the grammar for them. It really can't. But I mean, my job is to do more than that. Like they should learn their own grammar, but also my job is not to just kind of do the autocorrect job.
Yeah.
It's to sort of set them up to think about their work and to think about like what something that feels like a mistake might be trying to tell you about what your intentions were. It may be that there's a way that you want to commit to a mistake that makes it clear to the reader that you're doing it on purpose. It may be that it is a mistake, but it's pointing you in a direction that is more interesting than just making a kind of quick fix would be.
Yeah, I do think that's true and more interesting for sure. Danielle, it occurs to me I haven't read your bio yet. So let's do that a little unconventionally here in this moment. Danielle Evans is the author of the short story collection Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self. Winner of the 2021 Joyce Carol Oates Prize, the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize, the Hurston Wright Legacy Award, and the Patterson Prize, Danielle has also been a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree. She teaches in the writing seminars at Johns Hopkins University and has since won more awards, too. And you can also check out, Danielle, you have a website, an author website.
It's been so long since it's been updated. So
oh, no, okay.
Don't check it out yet. Give it me like one month to fix it.
Okay, or more. Like, let's think about time in generous ways.
Give me 1 month from a person who can't count to fix it.
let's take a short break. Today on Living Writers, Danielle Evans is here, the Office of Historical Corrections and Novella and Stories. When we're back, you'll hear some from this book. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away, and I know, hey, I'll leave the young thing alone, but ain't no sunshine when she. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Only darkness every day. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away. Anytime she goes away.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm glad you're here. Today, also here in the studio, Danielle Evans and her book, The Office of Historical Corrections, a Novella and Stories, out with Riverhead Books. Danielle will be reading tomorrow from the new manuscript, the novel. That's in the works. And so everyone, you can set your calendars for 5:30 p.m. at Uma Helmut Stern Auditorium. And then Danielle's got a craft talk on Friday morning at 10 a.m. at the Union. And thanks to Julie Cadman Kim and the Zell Visiting Writers Series for bringing Danielle here. Because it's really good to see you again. So Danielle, do you feel like reading something from the Office of Historical Corrections, a novella and stories?
Sure. To avoid the need for a lot of preface, I'm going to begin at the very beginning. So I'm reading the first few pages of the short story Happily Ever After, which is the first story in the collection. When Lissa was 7, her mother took her to see the movie where the mermaid wants legs, and when it ended, Lissa shook her head and squinted at the prince and said, "Why would she leave her family for that?" Which for years contributed to the prevailing belief that she was sentimental or soft-hearted, when in fact she just knew a bad trade when she saw one. The whole ocean for one man. Not that she knew much about the ocean. Lissa had been born in a landlocked state, and at 30 it seemed the closest she might get to the sea was her job working the gift shop in the lobby of the Titanic. It was not a metaphor. It was an actual replica of the Titanic with a mini museum on the lower level. Though most of their business came from weddings and children's birthday parties hosted on the upper decks. The ship-shaped building was a creation of the late 90s, the pet project of an enterprising educational capitalist who wanted to build an attraction both rigorous in its attention to historical detail and visually stunning. To preserve history, he said to the public, to capitalize off of renewed interest in the disaster, he said to his investors. He'd planned to build a scale, but that plan hadn't survived initial cost estimates. They'd only ever had a quarter of the passenger room as the actual Titanic had, and most of those rooms were now unfurnished and used as storage closets, their custom bed frames sold secondhand during the last recession. At the end of the summer season, a second-tier pop star rented the whole structure for a music video shoot, shutting down normal operations for 3 full days. Lisa had been planning on having the time off, but when the video's director came to finalize the plans for the space, he'd stopped in front of the shop glass, stared for a minute, then walked in and said, you're perfect. She agreed to remain on site for the filming and canceled the doctor's appointment she'd already rescheduled twice, giving herself in her head the lecture she imagined the doctor would have if he answered his own phone. Her coworker Mackenzie sulked around the ship for the rest of the afternoon, flinging herself into the director's line of vision without success. Mackenzie sometimes worked the gift shop counter with her, but only sometimes. Whenever there was a princess party, Mackenzie wore the costume dress and chaperoned as the princess on deck. Lisa never worked parties. The one time anyone had bothered to give her an explanation for this, she hadn't asked. It was a supervisor who mumbled something about historical accuracy, meaning no black princesses. We'd hate for the 6-year-olds having tea parties on the Titanic to get the wrong idea about history, Lisa said, so straight-faced that the supervisor failed to call her out for attitude.
Thanks, Danielle. Thanks. So why did Happily Ever After, why was this the lead story? Because it's been so cool hearing about the collection, how it took the time it took was this the earliest story that...
It was absolutely not. It was toward the later end of the process, not the very last story, but the second to last story. There was another story and there was a novella after that, but it was relatively close to the end of the book. And I heard this from Laura Vandenberg, but then I heard it from Lauren Groff, and I think Laura Vandenberg heard it from Lauren Groff. In any case, it comes from several women who I trust about short story collections, which is that the first story in a collection is the one that introduces most of the things that will come up again in the rest of the stories, right, that you want as a way into the collection to, in a way that we think of the collection as a conversation, I sometimes think of it as a series of like Venn diagrams, right, where the stories don't all, they're not, you don't want it to just be a circle, like you don't want all the stories to be kind of collapsing into each other, but you want there to be some point of connection between every story and some other stories, and the first story would be the one that's kind of in the middle and connected to all of the other things. And so I do think that story introduces the most concepts that come up again throughout the book. It also, I mean, it was a story that I had written. I rarely write, in fact, I think it's maybe, sometimes I write essays that are assigned to me and then I always regret immediately having signed off on for that because I'm just not a nonfiction writer. Like, I have all the respect in the world for nonfiction writers but every time I personally agree to do it, I'm like, this is not what I do and this is why. But I had agreed to write a short story kind of because Roxane Gay asked me to, and so
hard to say no.
and it was on the theme of the body, and so I'd written the story, and it was a relatively short word limit, and so when I gave the collection to my editor, she was like, "But why?" I was so proud because it was only 10 pages, and I'm like, usually it takes me 20 pages, and she was like, "But why does it have to only be 10 pages? Couldn't it be longer?" And I was like, "But it's only 10 pages," and she was like, "But there's," and she was right. Like, there was more, you know, what I had, because I had written that story. I think it was the year my mother died, and I can't remember whether it was just before or just after, but I think there was a place I couldn't get in the story, and I wasn't ready yet. And I think enough years had passed when I was revising it that I could kind of go back and rewrite that hospital scene with a little bit more visceral honesty. And that, I think, was important for the story. So it, it hadn't been that long between the first draft and the last draft, but I think it was important to have enough space that I could go back to it and say, like, this is how this book would honestly start.
Mm-hmm. Yes. How thinking about the beginnings and ways into the book, you also choose two quotes. So not one epigraph, but James Baldwin and Lucille Clifton. I'll give you the book back. We're sharing the book, everybody. Just in case, because that's also a moment where it's like a step, a pacing, an entering into. why did you choose these? And do you always have like sort of these other writers that are part of the lens?
Yeah. I mean, I think for a short story, I do like to have an epigraph. The novel doesn't have an epigraph yet. It may at some point. It feels maybe less imperative there, because I do think part of what I'm suggesting on the way into the collection is what to kind of look for across the stories, what to kind of think about. And I do think that this collection was very much about history, about honesty, about what it means to kind of live in both a personal and a national past, what it means to kind of lie about that, what it means to for there to be consequences for telling the truth. Like, most of the stories feel like in direct and indirect ways they're in some way about that. And so starting with these two epigraphs kind of signaled that without being too directly about the material itself.
Would you mind either, I don't know, could you
read? Yeah, you want me to read?
That would be, sure. Yeah, just so folks have a sense of it.
Yeah, the Baldwin epigraph is, "We know in the case of the person that whoever cannot tell himself the truth about his past is trapped in it, is immobilized in the prison of his undiscovered self. This is also true of nations. We know how a person in such a paralysis is unable to assess either his weaknesses or his strengths, and how frequently indeed he mistakes one for the other." And the Lucille Clifton epigraph is, "I am accused of tending to the past as if I made it, as if I sculpted it with my own hands. I did not. This past was waiting for me when I came." It ends on a comma, which I also think is interesting. That is actually how the line ends.
And so when did you pick those two? Like, were they, is that in the process of putting the collection together? Or were they ones, quotes, that were sort of orbiting around or in your orbit already?
I think the Baldwin quote was an epigraph for the novel that I had been working on that sort of turned into the novella. It was called something else, and it had a much more complicated project, and I think I abandoned it completely and said I was going to start over on a new book, and then I ended up starting over on what turned out into the novella because I realized that it was both a different version of the same project as opposed to a complete abandonment. Like, I'd given myself the freedom to abandon the things that were not working, which is, a lot of it was math. I had set it in like the near future that had become the recent past, and there were things that just didn't work. Like, the solving the problem of having an alternate present was just more a problem than needed solving. There were other problems with it too, but that was the main one, was I just kept having to redo math, and I thought, like, this is not what I signed up for. But when I went back to that novel, or when I started over on what I thought was a new novel, I realized it didn't actually need to be that long because I was getting rid of a lot of the complicated things that it didn't need. And I also realized that it was so much in conversation with the stories that I'd been doing that it was like, it felt like the final piece of the collection. And then I said, well, I don't care how long it is, because yes, if I were trying to like swap a novel for a novella, that might be like a challenging project. Although I do love like a tiny, delicate novel.
Yeah.
I don't know that publishers always do, but I thought, well, it doesn't matter, you know, it's going to go at the end of this collection, so it'll be how long it is, and I will just write it the length I think it needs to be, because I think it is the sort of final piece of this project that I have been in secret working on anyway. And so I think the Clifton quote did come in later, and I think that was after the collection was done. And I mean, I read Lucille Clifton all the time. I'd read, my mom, when she was sick, I was reading to her from Lucille Clifton's collected poems all the time. So I think probably it was this close to my heart in that moment.
And Lucille Clifton, also there's like the Lucille Clifton House in Baltimore.
Yeah. And they just, we were just at AWP there. So we had a lot of writers in Baltimore. And I think the Clifton House had a couple of great events. I, unfortunately, because my university was also one of the sponsors, had to be in four places at once and did not make it there. But it's a great resource. And I think they're really kind of building out their programming there now.
And your mom had loved Lucille Clifton too, her poems.
Yeah. So it was a thing that we could share toward the end.
With the Office of Historical Corrections, I just wanted to ask you about it becoming a novella. When you knew, because it's so interesting when you were sort of talking through it then, Danielle, it was changing. I realized I had thought it had come to be in a different way than how you were actually explaining that maybe it came to be. And I'm wondering, it's making me, because I was actually thinking this might have been an interesting commentary, because if this book was published in 2020, it would have been finished earlier, right? And I was thinking, so it would have been during the first Trump presidency, pretty much, and with those connections. Was that part of like the tricky bit of working with time? Because maybe when you started it, the ideas seemed more futuristic, and then it became the present in our lived contemporary history? Or
I think by that point I had two like post editing panic attacks when I was like, give me back the galley, I need to fix it, and my editor's assistant very kindly talked me down, and one of them was, I realized how many museum gift shops appeared in the collection, and I was like, there's too many, there's like five of them. And she was like, no, it's okay, we knew that. I was like, oh, I mean, I do think that like there's something about sort of commerce and repackaging of narratives and how we kind of both trivialize and obsess over history that makes sense in a museum gift shop. But I don't think I'd intentionally put that many of them in the book. And I was like, I've got to change the endings of like three of these stories. And she was like, no, it's all right. We knew that. The second panic attack was that I, like, the book was already, the galleys were out. It was in print. And the Office of Historical Corrections, the novella begins with this person kind of enforcing the observation of, not, that's, I'm overstating it, but it's a premise that like Juneteenth is a national holiday and that is widely observed in a sort of way that is also not necessarily historically respectful, and she's trying to fix it. And like, that was, the book was in galleys and it came out in November. So like, it was before the declaration. And so I was like, now I can't, like, this is going to feel like Law and Order. Like, I ripped it from the headlines. Like, this was supposed to signal that it was the future and it wasn't like the actual present. This is how I was fixing my time problem. And now I have a new time problem. And they were like, it's going to be okay. And that happens, you know, there's another story in here that like every time it was published, which is about kind of Confederate iconography. And the first time it was published was like a month after Charlottesville, but it was already in press. You know, it was like, I couldn't do anything about it. And then the second time when it came out in the collection, it was in Best American, and I forgot what had just happened, but it just felt like every time the story came out, it felt like it was responding to something that had been in the news like the week
that
before,
week, yeah.
But it was just happened to keep coming up. So I think that's, you know, that's one of the risks of contemporary fiction, is that sometimes you just are more topical than you intended to be. But no, Juneteenth was supposed to be how we knew that we were in an alternate future, not responsive to the present. It was just too late to change it. And I'm sort of glad that it was, because I think if it had been a month earlier, I would have said, like, let me make this something else that she corrects. So it's just because I would have been anxious about people reading it that way. But I think in the long life of the book, people are not going to remember, like, which order in which it came out. They're going to think about the kind of larger question if you've done your job right. So I think that I didn't actually need to be as distressed by it as I was, but I was distressed by it. It was because I didn't want people to think that I'd, like, written a novella in a month.
Anyone who knows you, Danielle, is going to know that you've already said, like, at the top of the hour here, you were like, it's because I'm slow. I'm slow with this. Like, they would know that this is, but also that it's happening. It feels like so many of the subconscious and the currents that you're writing into, because you said you're writing to be the first, you're the first reader who's surprised, you know?
Yes, I have fixed this problem by making the narrator of my novel a psychic. I'm telling the truth. I mean,
in
one
Black
of the
Magic,
narrators.
In Black Magic?
Yes.
That's great.
So yes, anything that I happen to get right there, we'll chalk it up to the structure.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's, and also maybe scary too, like, to start. Well, I'll look forward to Black Magic. I really will. So when you're writing the novel now, are you still writing short stories on the side?
I am not, which I think is a good sign. This has been a kind of also differently disruptive year for my life, but I find that when I feel anxious about getting back to a project, it is the novel that I'm excited to get to. I have a couple of short stories that are like unfinished and will probably get finished someday, but I have been kind of, this is where my brain is in this sort of bigger project and trying to untangle it.
And that's such a good sign for a novel, because will this be your first novel, or do you have a novel in a drawer somewhere?
I mean, just this one.
Well, no, it's not. This is a novella. Like, this became something else, like,
yeah,
in its own right.
So this will be the first one that actually gets finished as a novel. Sorry, I just...
That's okay.
Not on it. I forgot that we were in a radio studio and it's going to echo.
No, it's okay. Everybody's there with us. Yeah. So knock on wood. I'll knock on my head too. Okay. Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Today on Living Writers, Danielle Evans, her book, The Office of Historical Corrections, a novella and stories out with Riverhead Books. Tomorrow, Danielle will be reading and with a Q&A after at UMA at 5:30 with the Zell Visiting Writers series, and then a craft talk on Friday at 10 a.m. at the Union, Shifting Time and Perspective in Fiction. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
Just one of the guys. There's a little something inside that won't let me. No matter how hard I try to have an open mind, there's a little voice inside that prevents me.
Welcome back. You're just in time where we've got the last quarter of an hour here with Danielle Evans here on Living Writers, the Office of Historical Corrections, a novella and stories. I love that title. And I know you said it didn't originally have that title and that wasn't like it became this, the project. And there was also the Institute for Public History. Like there were so many great moments. And at the end of that novella, it's so interesting to me to know that you just had it in your life in so many different ways, where I just felt like with Jeannie and Cassie, I just felt like it was just so heartbreaking at the end.
Yeah. I mean, I think working out the tone of that project was part of the, even carrying over from when it was a novel, I think one of the reasons that it failed as a novel was that it originally was trying to write a satire and spent 5 years trying to write a story that was more purely satirical. And I think I thought that was possible because I'm full of rage and moderately funny, but I am also like fundamentally tender and earnest. Like, so I think I spent a long time lying to myself about that before I realized I couldn't get the tone right for a satire. Like the characters were sort of too protective of them to put them in a purely satirical novel. Like, not protective, I guess I do terrible things to them in this book, but there was some way in which, I don't know, I couldn't get enough distance from it to make it satire. And I had to lean into the fact that it was going to feel kind of more sentimental than I wanted to, but I also had to build into that a way to kind of protect the narrative from that, because I think part of why it's a novella and not a short story is that it takes the narrator a long time to get to what the story is actually about. There's a way in which she's sort of hiding the outcome from herself in the retelling, and that was it was an interesting way to understand the character and also a way to kind of solve some of the tonal shifts in the piece. And I think that was actually the last edit I did, was rewrite it from third person to first person, because it just wasn't working in third person, because there's a way that you can get away with a little bit of narrative sleight of hand or dishonesty in first person if it feels authentic to the person telling the story, that like if you yourself as the writer or narrator are doing it feels manipulative or just doesn't work, it feels ineffective. And so most of that collection is in third person because I was interested in a lot of narrators who didn't necessarily, or protagonists rather, who didn't know what story they were in. I think a first-person narrator has to believe they know what the story is. Mm. And they may or may not be right, but there's some reason that there's a shape they've given the story that they believe is the correct shape. Mm-hmm. And so it's most interesting to me to have a first-person narrator if they actually are telling the story and you have to figure out why, or if they're telling you what they think is the story, but they're kind of actively concealing the story from themselves. There's actually one of my favorite things about the Edward P. Jones story I mentioned earlier is that even though there is that sort of interrupting clause right away, so much of the story, even the tense itself, is about like fighting the passage of time on the page. And so I think that there was a way in which I wanted to think about what do we do to try not to get to the end of the story because we don't want to acknowledge how it ended or that we weren't necessarily able to do what we thought we would or hoped we would. And that was an interesting contrast, I think, to a lot of narrators or a lot of main characters in this text who were just kind of floundering or believing themselves to be in control of decisions or telling you the part of the story that didn't matter while the part that mattered kind of snuck up on them. Like this was a kind of more active disavowal of the part of the story that mattered, but it did eventually have to get to the part that hurt.
And I wouldn't say that anything was sentimental. That's the thing. I don't know. I think because I didn't. I don't know. I think it's something to do with how the last exchange between those two characters, Cassie and Jeannie, and that you let Jeannie have the last phrase.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also interested. I've been talking a lot about the friendship plot. Like, I know we think about the marriage plot sometimes in talking about fiction and construction of novels. And I think the interesting thing about friendship is that, you know, there can be an event, but friendship doesn't require an event to kind of sign on, but it also doesn't require an event to dissolve. And so often when you have a friend, what you have inherently is somebody who's been a witness to a long period of your life and creates a kind of natural rhyming action. And so like when they choose each other and when they don't, when they kind of disavow each other and when they're friends, they're kind of frenemies. But it's kind of an interesting plot in that there's a way that they both keep each other honest and also avoid that because we don't always want to see an honest map of our lives.
Yes.
And there's also a way in which I think that they're, you know, neither of them is a punchline because they're both trying in a situation that isn't like designed to do what they want it to do. And so some of what they're doing is not effective, and some of what they're doing is maybe being too hard on other people in the same situation, but the larger problem is not either of them or even some of the people that they're fighting with. It's a kind of that the project they're doing is not designed to work.
And it's so interesting to have these characters set in this time as a commentary on contemporary American politics.
So, I mean, I grew up in D.C., and I think that I grew up in D.C. kind of thinking about the complicated relationships that Black Americans have to the federal government. I think that government employees, even before, like, you know, obviously we're in a whole other kind of crisis now, but I think I have a soft spot for people who are trying to do their best in bureaucracies, who are often, like, doing very important work under like structural conditions that are not ideal. I also understand that there's a way in which taking on that job sometimes means you are the voice of a thing that you don't believe in, or that you are tasked with a thing that at a certain point crosses an ethical line. And so thinking about all the different kinds of ways bureaucracy operates, and some of them are actually very important and kind of keep things afloat, like, and all of it kind of gets a bad name. But I think as a person from DC, as a person who understands that like the federal government integrating kind of built the Black middle class, which for better and for worse, like there are, you know, that is not necessarily an endorsement of the class structure or of every government action, but there's a kind of complicated relationship to power that I think I grew up seeing and wanted to think about in that text and think about what does it mean to be a person who does a job as a public servant because you want to serve the public, and what tools do you have and what tools do people think that you have that you actually don't? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this was obviously like it's not a realist work entirely. It goes into a slightly sort of absurdist version of that. But I was interested in thinking about it. And I do kind of have a soft spot for DC's brutalist architecture. Yes. I genuinely do.
I was trying to figure that out on the first couple of pages for sure. Because I was like, is this part of the humor? Because I love the humor that goes throughout this, because the humor is sometimes right next to the most painful thing. So that's how it seems to be working. But I think you should have the I'd love how you said tender and earnest and a soft spot for DC. I feel like now it's like true confessions on Living Writers here.
It's a list of things I like that are embarrassing.
Oh, we should have started with that. I wanted to also note that often in collections, I really appreciate looking at the acknowledgments at the very end for the writer, and if you don't mind, I wanted to say, like at the end, you do have here in the acknowledgments, this book is, among many other things, about grief and loss and about women unwilling to diminish their desires to live full and complex lives. And then in naming people in your life that have been part of it and were then gone as well. And how the book is, we were talking about like the first story you chose and the epigraphs and the book is dedicated to your mom. And she also has the last paragraph in the acknowledgments as well. And I thought it was just so, so beautiful how you're linking like whose love, speaking of your mom, whose love made me believe in myself, whose love for telling stories made me believe in their power and for whom I will be trying to find the right words for the rest of my life. I feel like I can't wait to read the novel, Danielle, because I feel like you are always finding the right words.
Thank you. I'm trying. I'm doing my best.
And for this moment in time, and we'll see what happens next. Thank you so much for being here today and talking on the radio and being game for conversation number two of Living Writers.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to still be a living writer, so thank you for having me back.
See you in 15 years? Maybe.
Hopefully sooner this time.
Okay, a deal. Today on Living Writers, Danielle Evans, the book on the table, The Office of Historical Corrections, a novella and stories out with Riverhead Books. Like we've mentioned throughout today's program that we're taping today, it's live, it's not taped, but this is Wednesday, March 25th, 2026, because I know we'll be re-airing the show in the future. But Danielle will be reading in our present time. God, now I'm really messed up with time too. I'm probably confusing.
Started a trend.
Yeah. Thanks, Danielle. Danielle, in our present time, will be reading with a Q&A after at UMA tomorrow, Thursday at 5:30 p.m. And then there's that craft talk on Friday at the Union at 10 a.m., Shifting Time and Perspective in Fiction. Thanks so much to Reverend Andrew for engineering, for JAV for pulling the songs, to the Zell Visiting Writers series for bringing Danielle Evans here. Thanks to my mom for listening and for all you out there listening. Until next time, I'm T. Hetzel.
Thank you.
Everything I do in slow motion. I don't know what to say. Everywhere I fall, don't know name or location. Maybe I'll just find my way. I'll find it.
Got any action for me?
Um,
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just go around real quick.
Here. Here.
All right. Hello. 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 Caleb, Jake.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Caleb.
Just speaking to the mic.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah, yeah, you're good.
Okay, I'm not plugged in.
Here, I'll hold on.
That's
here, just. Thank you.
Where's our jingle? Where's our jam? Here we go.
Thanks, Jake.
All right. All right, just 20 seconds.
The world of sports on
WCPN. Yo, yo! That's my new intro. I just feel, you know, gives a little energy, gets the guys juice, gets the guys going. Welcome back to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. It is 6 p.m., which means it's time for your daily sports report. I'm your host, Paul Englade. Those who heard my National Basketball Association dialogue yesterday, glad you managed to sit through and suffer with me. Philadelphia 76ers are still a terrible basketball team, but today I'm here and I got guys with me. I got Caleb, I got Jack, got Jake, got Andrew Pipta. How we doing today?
Oh, so well.
Pretty good. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Better after that intro now. Yeah, I'm feeling better.
See, that's it. See, that's what I like to see. That's why we get along so well. Now, we just kind of discussed it a bit in the, before the show. But I came across a good friend who doesn't really know that much about basketball. Probably hasn't really touched basketball in his life. But he said, "Paul, do you think if Howard had played Duke, they would have won?" And I sat there and I thought to myself, Siena, worst team. Duke, two of their best players were not playing. Siena lost by only 5. You know, and, you know, Howard, I think is, we can all say, objectively better than Siena. Gave Michigan a fight. We're only down by 4 to the Wolverines at halftime in the first round. Where, actually, we got the guys here. Got Jake and Andrew, got myself. We're there in Buffalo, witnessed some scenes. Yaxel Lanneborg poster against St. Louis in the second